Well, hello everyone, and welcome to the teleclass, Forever the Unknown, the Lujovirus Experience in Johannesburg. My name is Paul Weber, and on behalf of my colleague, Dr. Syed Sattar, I'd like to welcome you to what will inevitably be one of my favorite teleclasses in 2010. Now, I say that because our presenter today is Professor Adriano Duzé, one of my favorite lecturers. Professor Duzé is the chair, academic head, and chief specialist of the Department of Clinical Microbiology and Infectious Disease at the School of Pathology of the National Health Laboratory Service and the University of the Witwatersrand in Johannesburg, South Africa. And if that sounds like an impressive title, it's probably because Professor Duzé is a very impressive man. In fact, I dare say that where there is an outbreak of odd or novel disease, or when such persistent and horrid infections exist that others are baffled, Adriano Duzé is the go-to person. When there was Rift Valley fever in Kenya, he was there. When Marburg virus hit Angola, he was there. Lassa fever, Ebola, hepatitis, the omnipresent HIV, Adriano Duzé has been a part of all of these and many more besides, including, of course, the Lujovirus outbreak, about which we'll hear more in a moment. He is also a very nice and very humble man who gives a tremendously interesting lecture. It's a great honor to have him with us today. From Johannesburg, South Africa, to present Forever the Unknown, the Lujovirus Experience in Johannesburg, I am very happy to present Professor Adriano Duzé. Adriano.
Thank you, Paul, for your kind introduction, and greetings to all that are listening to this teleclass from Johannesburg. Very wintry and cold, but successful, buzzing place because we've recently hosted the World Cup, which has been extremely well received. We are going to talk about the Lujovirus, which is an interesting novel agent, and the context within which it arose was equally surprising. So if we move on to the first slide, we just want to recap that we know that there are several types of vectors for hemorrhagic fevers. And in Africa, we have those transmitted by mosquitoes, such as yellow fever and Rift Valley fever, those transmitted by ticks, such as Crimean Congo hemorrhagic fever, which is not unique to Africa, but is certainly very prevalent in our continent. Those transmitted by rodents, such as Lassa fever. And yes, you'll see a new name there, Lujovirus, an organism strongly and closely associated with the arenaviruses, initially thought to have been a Lassa fever-like virus that was the novel emerging pathogen that we found in this country 2 years ago. And then finally, there are also the hemorrhagic fevers which have got Baxter's reservoirs, and those include Ebola, Marburg. Moving on to the next slide, I think it's important to remember that at all times, bacterial septicemia is by far the commonest cause of bleeding and fever in a patient. We have, in fact, quite a big problem with meningococcal septicemia and meningitis in our country, as well as a wide variety of other diseases. So almost invariably, the vast majority of hemorrhagic and feverish patients usually have an underlying septicemia. However, we can never really be too complacent because there are on occasion novel organisms that can enter our country or manifest themselves in one way or another. And we need to remember that we always have to have a high degree of alert and of an ethic of infection containment at all times, because we never know what we're dealing with at any given point in time. Rickettsial infections, such as African tick bite fever caused by Rickettsia rickettsii and other rickettsias, are extremely important in the differential, as are spirochetal infections, particularly leptospirosis, for which we had a case in our hospital only a week ago, malaria, and other viruses that are not necessarily linked with the viral hemorrhagic fever group. Non-infective causes of bleeding and fever are important. We need to consider them quite carefully. We know that certain neoplastic conditions, sensitivities to drugs, use of anticoagulants, poisons, particularly rodent poisons, snake bites, glue sniffing, and very big in sub-Saharan Africa traditional medicines, can all give rise to fever and bleeding in patients. I want to start going on to the next slide to the broad principles about the approach to hemorrhagic fever. And these, if you like, are really blanket rules or laws that we need to always bear in mind. And if we bear these general principles in mind, we should be fine and relatively prepared when we eventually do encounter one of these formidable agents. Firstly, VHFs, as I said earlier, are an uncommon cause of fever and bleeding. So you always need to be highly suspicious and take into consideration a wide variety of factors, like a travel history of a patient and so on, before you, when you are presented with a patient with fever and bleeding. Secondly, laboratory confirmation always takes a long time, so there's usually a fairly long period during which you wait for laboratory screens to come back. These are specialized viral tests and so on. And during the long period of time, you have to decide whether you're going to maintain isolation and containment precautions or not. And generally, this is where people make most of the mistakes. They seem to actually dismiss the possibility of hemorrhagic fevers being present, only to find that different types of assays pick them up at various points over even as long as the 1 month period. The third important point is that nosocomial transmission and amplification of hemorrhagic fevers, with exception of Rift Valley fever, where we haven't had any cases described amongst doctors and nurses, certainly yes, we have had them in laboratorians, but not doctors and nurses, is well described. And I think the bottom line is that if we don't stick to standard precautions at all times and make sure that when we have people that are bleeding and feverish, we need to always observe contact precautions with infectious blood, tissues, excreta, etc. Sharps and splash injuries must be minimized at all times, and mechanical aerosolization of infectious particles must be avoided, and this will become clearer as we move along in this talk, where because mechanical aerosolization was required for the patients involved in this particular outbreak, appropriate precautions should have been taken for them to have aborted this infection. The second slide, or next slide, shows general principles too. And we just really want to make the point that all previously listed VHF agents are extremely labile and very readily killed by simple disinfection. The agents are lipid-enveloped RNA viruses here in Africa, and even ordinary detergent, if not weak solutions of hypochlorite, are capable of rendering these agents inactive and therefore non-infective. Survival, particularly in blood samples and blood and body fluid incrustation on medical devices and environmental surfaces, is variable. It can last from days to weeks, so one must not underestimate blood-stained paraphernalia such as lines, catheters, and so on, and the adequate disposal to prevent contact with these items. On the following slide, General Principle 3, you realize that generally, we always adhere to simple and realistic infection prevention control precautions, and then we start tailoring those precautions to either known mode of transmission or an inferred mode of transmission by looking at surrogate agents. When we were told that Luja virus was really an arena virus and probably was extremely closely related to Lassa fever virus, what we obviously did is we used Lassa fever as the overall comparator of the biological behavior and other characteristics that we needed to keep in mind in order to try and keep these patients free of infection and protect other healthcare workers from acquiring it. It's also important that whatever you do, whenever you put personal protective equipment, you try and put the protective equipment on in manners that are logical, sequential, and simple. Please remember that when you put personal protective equipment for VHFs, the donning of the protective equipment is important because it must be done properly. But the greatest risk occurs in the removal of this equipment, because if you don't do it in a very careful and sequential manner, potential exposure of the healthcare worker to the virus may occur. We never in South Africa de-escalate infection prevention control precautions on the basis of initial negative RT-PCR. We only do so when we either reach a definitive diagnosis that the patient is not a VHF, or the patient is discharged, or the patient is dead. And that is a principle that has kept us quite safe in many outbreaks. So initially, there were negative molecular assays for VHFs, which ultimately turned out positive. Also, please be careful in the viral hemorrhagic fevers. Frequently, we see that patients, particularly when they have had a very turbulent period in their well-being and during the course of the illness, these patients might actually seem to show signs of spontaneous improvement. And sometimes the signs of spontaneous improvement seem to be pre-mortal events. So shortly after that, the patients crash, and you start finding that they go into multi-organ failure and they are really exceptionally ill and usually die. The following slide shows a slide that I've shown before in these teleclasses, and this is how you can achieve from high-level containment using Racal respirators, which is the second and third slide on the top, right down to basic PPE that can be available anywhere and accessible in all healthcare facilities, and that is using impervious gowns, double gloving, a good respirator mask, protective eyewear, and also shoe protection. We've said before that high-level containment approaches, such as expensive Racal respirators that really pump in HEPA-filtered air, are really not necessarily a good idea. Firstly, people find them difficult to operate. They are extremely heavy. They mist over. And if you're not trained to use these safely and effectively, you can paradoxically increase your risk of exposure to blood and body fluids. And always an important principle that we keep in mind is that whatever you can't give to all levels of healthcare facility, for example, people in an ordinary clinic, should not be available only in tertiary centers. All occupational healthcare requirements in our country really relate to all categories of healthcare workers, and we all need to have fairly similar principles of and levels of protection. The next slide obviously goes on. Let's limit staff exposure. Ideally in South Africa, particularly in Johannesburg, we dedicate senior, willing, and more experienced staff to these outbreaks. And it's extremely unreasonable to keep nursing shifts longer than 4 hours, simply because the stress of nursing patients with suspected VHFs is very high, and accident proneness increases quite dramatically after 4 hours. We want to at all times warn and educate all relevant personnel involved in healthcare delivery and tell them about the disease, how it's transmitted. Frequently, there's a huge panic element that is characteristic of these outbreaks. And if we don't talk to all healthcare workers, including auxiliary services in the hospital and the laboratory, pandemonium can arise. We generally try and limit laboratory tests to the minimum, and we discuss or negotiate times of processing of samples with the physicians that are looking after the patients. And if we were to do really the most basic investigations, we would start off always with, of course, a full blood count, hemoglobin, platelets, and coagulation studies. We would do liver function tests, but limit ourselves to two parameters, the transaminases, ALT and AST, blood cultures, CSF as necessary, and peripheral blood smears are mandatory. The peripheral blood smears are for blood parasites or leptospirosis, for example, and this is in fact when we always have to look at what goes on in the blood. Serological and viral investigations are done in a tiered sequence, so we look for the most common agent first and then start actually tiering it down to other agents. And if there are any other tests that are required, they have to be discussed and arranged with the laboratory. Next is to be sure that at all times you set up a representative and suitably qualified outbreak team. Avoid impractical bits of advice. Avoid protocols that nobody can follow. Avoid policies that are directly imported from other countries where the infrastructure that is local does not enable them to be implemented. Make sure that everybody sends a single message, that everybody's on the same track, so that in essence you don't get multiple mixed messages being put into the outbreak stream that cause tremendous confusion and panic. We define and classify for each outbreak what we consider to be high, medium, or low-risk contacts, and we then always start monitoring all the people that have been in contact with a suspected patient and tracing other patients that might be roaming around that are not on your list. And usually we use 21 days of full surveillance quarantine monitoring, which means that people can go to work and carry on with all of the activities, provided they report twice daily temperatures to us, after which we will intervene only if temperatures are abnormal and upon clinical consultation with the patient. Make sure that patients are appropriately informed, that the communities are socially mobilized, and that accurate, honest, responsible information goes from the media. So it's always important to establish a hotline and an operation center. Moving on to our last few slides of general principles, at all times during an outbreak, you've got to continuously evaluate the efficacy of the infection prevention control interventions. Understand that you may be wrong, and I think the next important point is that either way, whether you've done too much or too little, criticism and judgment are inevitable when you review your actions retrospectively. Be aware of case definitions that are too wide and denominators that are incorrectly defined. You've got to always ask yourself as the outbreak evolves, does this all make biological and epidemiological sense? In the case of some of the outbreaks that we see in South Africa, we know that we've got porous borders, whereby transfer patients across our borders that are airlifted from Central Africa occurs quite frequently. And what we do need to do is, in fact, to see a strict enforcement of port health regulations, preventing people to come unauthorized across our borders and presenting with, in fact, severe illnesses in our hospitals. And also one must remember that each outbreak is unique in its many ways. It may be unique in terms of clinical manifestations, in terms of its biological and epidemiological evolution. There may be personal agendas in outbreak responses, egos, political agendas, public health agendas that are all in fact completely conflicting and not in the greater interest of everybody. So these are things that we need to remember. The next slide shows viral hemorrhagic fevers isolation precautions in a nutshell. We certainly don't have negative pressure cubicles readily available in South African hospitals. So on the knowledge that most of these viral hemorrhagic fevers that we see in Africa are only spread if you mechanically aerosolize the virus through, for example, suctioning and other procedures that result in making viral particles airborne, we generally focus on contact precautions and on protection of the mucous membranes. So we do not use negative pressure cubicles. We don't believe viruses are going to escape from rooms, and we don't believe that without significant contact to inocular, you will get the disease. We always believe that this is a good time to reinforce simple standard and contact precautions, but then we actually start introducing enhanced VHF personal protective equipment, which include contact precautions to deal with aerosols and also obviously precautions to make sure that the skin and mucous membranes are protected. Crucial is to always safely disinfect spills. Monitoring of your waste is very important. In many of the outbreaks that I have been involved, the disposal of waste from these patients with hemorrhagic fevers is extremely inadequate. And you need to take responsibility for all the waste that is generated at the outset to the very end. Thorough terminal cleaning and decontamination of a room when the patient is either evacuated or dead is important, as well as medical equipment. We never destroy medical paraphernalia or equipment. We certainly don't actually quarantine respirators. We simply actually decontaminate everything thoroughly and make our intensive care units open for continuous service of other patients. Corpses always provide the possibility of contact with blood and body fluids. for example, excrement that you might come across, which is blood soiled from patients who've recently demised and are having the last offices performed, can be dangerous. We don't believe in removing lines from patients if they die in an intensive care, simply because despite the fact that the patient is dead and the heart is not beating, obviously, huge splash aerosols have actually come out of the line tracks when we remove them from patients. And it's also important to remember to educate family members and everybody else regarding sexual activity, because patients who convalesce from these hemorrhagic fevers may remain infectious for long periods of time and transmit the infection sexually to partners. Now we get to arenaviruses, of which Lujavirus is an example. Let's briefly have a look at the arenavirus characteristics. Arenaviruses are negative sense, single-stranded RNA viruses, and most of them cause chronic infections in rodents, which are their reservoirs, and are excreted from urine. The rodents, typically, that we are often exposed to in the literature are multimammate mice, which are rather large, rat-like looking animals, although they're mice with nipples that indicate the fact they've got multi-mammary glands. There are more than 20 species of arenaviruses that have been identified, and human transmission typically has occurred from contaminated food or household items, possibly from making dust with airborne viral particles being present on that dust, and certainly contact with infected blood and body fluids. Although we talk about, in fact, airborne transmission of arenavirus Lassa fever, we do believe that mechanical actions need to occur for the viruses to be made transiently airborne, and they're not typically spread by the airborne route as might TB, for example, be. The arenaviruses are classified as the old world arenaviruses, of which the prototype is the lymphocytic chorioamnionitis virus. In Africa, these include Lassa fever, Ipi, Mabala, and Morogoro virus. The latter is not really pathogenic in humans, the latter three, Ipi, Mabala, Morogoro. The New World arenaviruses are those that are found in South America, and they include the viruses like Junin and Machupo. The slide that follows is really a dendrogram showing relationships of different types of viruses. And you'll see in yellow that the Luja virus, which was actually described here in South Africa, is extremely closely linked to Lassa virus. And indeed, it is one of the old world arenaviruses that we have seen for the first time in 1998 in our country. The following slide, as I press this down, you'll see that Lassa fever, for example, as a virus, is well known to us in Africa. It was first described in the 1950s in West Africa, isolated in Nigeria, and it causes infections in a geographical strip that includes Guinea, Liberia, Sierra Leone, and Nigeria. And we see some 300,000 to 500,000 cases per year in Africa, with some 5,000 related deaths. The important point about Lassa virus is that it is responsive to ribavirin, so it's a useful antiviral drug to use. And indeed, the patients with Luja virus, the closely related Lassa fever-like virus that was newly described, that were treated with ribavirin at correct levels did relatively well. The next slide really shows something that was of historical interest and really very much what we found to be an ominous prelude to what happened in South Africa. And this was this document where they go back to the discovery of Lassa fever, where on the 26th of January 1969, a nurse died at the Bingham Hospital, and she was the first recorded victim of Lassa fever. 8 days later, the nurse who had attended her, Charlotte Shaw, began to show severe back and leg pains and a slight headache, and her temperature rose alarmingly quickly. She then developed a macular rash, discoloration of the skin, face, and neck, and strange ulcers appeared in her throat. Swellings that were really peculiar, and then, of course, hypertension and ultimately septic shock and death. And then yet again, another nurse. So this JOS outbreak in Nigeria was really much a nosocomial outbreak. The clinical features of not just a high temperature, a severe headache on occasion, severe back pain, neck pain, discoloration of the skin, ulceration of the mouth, were all characteristic also in our outbreak of Luja that was predominantly an outbreak that involved healthcare workers. In Africa, there have been several descriptions of Lassa fever and nosocomial outbreaks. In 1989 was the outbreak described in the British Medical Journal with the two hospital outbreaks in the Imo State. And amongst the 34 cases, there was nosocomial amplification amongst patients, as well as nurses, surgeons, physicians, and the son of a patient. Most of the cases were exposed in hospitals, and the attack rate in one hospital was 55%. And the characteristic features of both hospitals was inadequate equipment and staffing, poor medical practice, reuse of syringes, fueling the epidemic in a very big way. Moving on to the next slide, our outbreak of Luja virus, which is the novel old world virus that was described, really involved the transportation of our primary case from Zambia to South Africa. The epicenter of the outbreak happened to be a private hospital in Sandton, Gauteng, and our primary case was a safari tour agent. People that came into contact with her was the paramedic, number two, that airlifted her from Zambia to South Africa, a nurse that looked after her while she was in intensive care, and a cleaner who actually cleaned the ward once she had demised and possibly had become exposed to blood or body fluids during the cleaning process, which was not conducted in a safe manner. And finally, the fifth case was, in fact, number five, was a nurse that also took care of one of the secondary cases, and we'll go through the chronology of all of these events shortly. Moving to the next slide, our case definition was extremely broad initially, but because we realized this was not a community outbreak and you needed, in order to qualify, to be a high suspect patient, to have had close contact with one of the patients in the current cluster, a suspected case was deemed to be an acute onset of documented fever, either an oral temperature of 38 degrees or more, or an axillary temperature of greater or equal to 37.5. In hemorrhagic fevers, it's often not advocated to take oral temperatures for obvious reasons and for potential exposures to blood and body fluids in saliva. So axillary temperatures are frequently used as surrogates, but you need to obviously make sure that you understand that it will be somewhat lower. And secondly, they had to have a history of direct or close contact with one of the confirmed cases in the current clusters in the 21 days after the onset had occurred in these cases of illness. So basically what we realized was that strangely, we don't know where this virus came from. We didn't have any knowledge of a background epidemic in Zambia at the time where the safari tour operator was working. And we certainly didn't have any background epidemic in our communities of Luja virus fever. And we noticed that all of the cases, especially when the epidemic rolled itself out, were linked exclusively to the primary patient, the safari tour operator, and all of the events that occurred in other people becoming ill were really as a consequence of this initial event. So the outbreak was purely nosocomial, and how and where Luja virus exists in its natural reservoir, we are not 100% sure. Moving on, the case definitions defined a probable case as having been a suspected case with a history of a direct contact with one of the confirmed arenaviral cases, plus one or more of the following. We took thrombocytopenia, and we decided we would use either clinical criteria and or laboratory criteria, because you often don't get laboratory criteria in the field in other less equipped parts of Africa, and you often have to realize that you need to use surrogates that are purely clinical for thrombocytopenia, mucous membrane hemorrhages or petechiae and so on. So that was a probable case. A confirmed case was one that was determined by a definitive positive laboratory test for rhinovirus, as confirmed and reported by the National Institute of Communicable Diseases here in Johannesburg and their collaborating partners, which included, in fact, various collaborating parties from the US. Just to give you a summary of each case history, the primary case, it was a 33-year-old female, as we said, she was a tour operator living in Lusaka. She arrived at the Sandton Private Hospital in South Africa, which was evacuated for medical care on the 12th of September 2008. She was critically ill when she was being airlifted, and apparently on arrival was to hospital was considered to be brain dead. When they looked at her and examined her carefully, they thought that she had in fact African tick bite fever because they noticed an eschar resembling a tick bite on the right foot. And people also then started thinking, well, could this not have been, in fact, Congo-Crimean hemorrhagic fever? And the differential was largely around tick bite fever and CCHF. The patient died 2 days later, and as mentioned, the source of infection remains undetermined. The second case was a 33-year-old male who was a paramedic, and he basically cared for the safari tour operator during air evacuation. And we know that he performed procedures such as nebulization, suctioning, and manual ventilation of the patient during the flight. A second paramedic who was admitted for observation at Sandton Hospital was responsible for the ambulance transport of the patient from the airport to the hospital. And he noted that his evacuation colleague had excrete on his forearm because he had actually tried to turn the patient and move her during air evacuation. The paramedic that was part of the air evacuation team was admitted on the 27th of September and died a few days later on the 2nd of October. The third case was a 34-year-old female who was a nurse who cared for the primary case, the safari tour operator in intensive care unit. Exactly what her contact was is not clear, but she had attended to the patient and had also cleaned the body of the patient once the patient had actually been declared dead. This particular nurse, the 40-year-old female, case 3, was admitted to private hospital on the 1st of October and died on the 5th of October in 2008. Case number 4 was a hospital cleaner, 38-year-old male who performed terminal cleaning of an ICU room of our primary case. And the cleaning allegedly, although we couldn't get confirmation of it, involves spray washing of walls. She was admitted being quite ill with multiple pathologies. She had a chronic immunosuppressive disease. She was thought to have TB, but also was extremely sick. She went to two public facilities. She was first seen at one hospital and then another, and this obviously amplified the number of contacts that she had been with. When she was finally transferred in our VHF isolation unit, she had been confirmed to be a victim of Luja virus, and she demised on the 6th of October 2008. Case number 5 was a 47-year-old female. She was a nursing sister. She cared for the paramedic that actually had airlifted our patient from Zambia to South Africa. And she was involved in a particularly traumatic insertion of a central venous catheter. She became sick on the 9th of September 2008, was admitted to a Sandton Private Hospital on the 10th of September. Her condition was very serious. She had a very turbulent course, but she was, in fact, eventually stable. And she was treated with first oral and then intravenous ribavirin. And after really many, many, many weeks of difficult time from both patient management point of view and for her herself, she remained the only survivor of all of our 5 cases. The exposures on the next slide that we were able to document is that paramedic 2 was witnessed to have turned the primary case without gloves in a Zambian hospital prior to air evacuation, and a peripheral intravascular catheter was dislodged and several drops of blood fell onto the bed sheet that the paramedic was handling. Cases 1 to 4, the patients were all initially managed without special PPE. In other words, they did not have appropriate protective barriers for their respiratory mucosas, and basically only simple plastic aprons are worn, and we're not 100% certain whether gloves were donned at all times. But healthcare workers and cleaners were also potentially exposed to contaminated bedding, excrete, and vomitus from the patient. We didn't have any needle, stick, or splash injury recorded, so that type of event was not responsible for the exposure. And only case 5, managed with full PPE, recovered. And because full PPE was used with case 5, and that was the last surviving case, no further amplification occurred in hospital. If you move on to the next line, you can see really an epidemic curve mapping that enabled us to really determine roughly what was going on with this new viral infection. Spanning from September to October, we were able to really map out the chronology of sequence of exposure, possible incubation, onset of symptoms, period of morbidity, admission to hospital, and death. And the incubation period for this disease seems to be somewhere between about 7 to 13 days, with a morbid period also being about 10 to 13 days. The next slide shows you how only one patient airlifted from Zambia, by the time you start having direct contacts and contacts with contacts that have been seen at various healthcare facilities, really generates and amplifies in a very big way the number of total contacts that need to be followed up for 21 days after the last case has actually been discharged and been deemed to be clear of blood, of blood viremia with VHF. So the important point is that it's only one patient that is airlifted, but look at how many contacts that needed to be followed up that were relatively significant, and it was 185 in total. Here you can see the chronology of when, in fact, the contacts were followed up. At all points, from the beginning to the end, we wanted to ensure that a 21-day period was covered, for every one of those 21 days, people couldn't travel out of the province, nor could they actually declare themselves to be ill without undergoing some type of medical evaluation. The functions of the infection prevention control team in this outbreak was to develop case and contact definitions and also case assessment forms, to formulate appropriate infection prevention control policy, to audit all the facilities where the suspected and confirmed cases were seen or admitted, assess all the suspected cases, manning the hemorrhagic fever ward at our hospital, educating about arenaviruses, and training about correct use of PPE. And this was done, in fact, right throughout various services like port health, emergency medical services, etc. Counseling of patients and healthcare workers was crucially important, as was distribution to PPE to facilities, monitoring of contacts, making sure that laboratory biosafety was maintained, and waste disposal audits were carried out. The core team on the next slide is me in the center and two of the most wonderful practitioners, Geraldine Sharp on the left and Dr. I'll point them out to you, Tuhadin on the right. And this team was responsible for the education that you see on this following slide, the extensive education, the presentation, teaching how to don personal protective equipment that was carried out in many facilities, simply because there was such a huge element of panic and everybody wanted to be sure that they knew what to do. The following slide again shows education with regards to training of PPE, donning of PPE in practice. You can see people watching on. As we've mentioned previously, it's very easy to don PPE correctly. It's very difficult to remove it safely. So making sure that all of these processes were clearly understood by healthcare workers was crucial. On the bottom part of the slide, you can see that even in relatively controlled environments, the disposal of waste was an absolute disaster. You can see that there are syringes and needles, as well as medical waste coming from the VHF-infected patients, simply actually dumped in cardboard boxes, purely due to sloppiness, and left there, creating a very potentially dangerous reservoir or source for people to come into contact with and get infection. Our PPE is generally limited to a Tyvek oversuit or surgical scrub suit with impervious gowns and disposable balaclavas. Double gloving is important. N95 respirators are used, either goggles or visors, and impervious overshoes. So here you can see the makeshift VHF ward that was created at the private hospital. People with perfectly doable PPE, you can see that Racal respirators are not in use, and that in fact all the processes are maintained in order to try and keep strict isolation of patients so that only the nurse inside the cubicle is in direct contact with the patient, and as mentioned previously, and doctors obviously when they visit the patient, but as mentioned previously, for no longer than 4-hour periods at any given time. So the last slide really brings us to the fact that frequently we will be criticized in outbreaks for having done overkill or for doing too little. But the bottom of the bottom line is that if we don't really do everything that we can, given our understanding of a biological agent, to contain a disease, should there be further cases, you are going to be blamed. So we need to remember that patients are at the forefront of the efforts of our activities. We need to remember that healthcare workers are extremely precious, and it is keeping safety at all costs of patients and healthcare workers at all times that is the priority of our healthcare, of our outbreak team. So with that, I wish to say goodbye to you. I hope you have a wonderful time, and would like to invite you also to, by all means, send emails. Paul Weber will have the details should you have any questions.
Adriano, thank you very much. Tremendous presentation. Again, this is in fact your fourth teleclass lecture with us. The other three are available in the recordings libraries, the handouts and the recordings. I just wanted to note, is that on slide 33, there's a picture in the bottom right-hand corner with three people in proper PPE and one handsome fellow looking on wearing nothing. Is that you?
Yes, it's me. And the PPE is fortunately not a Racal respirator. All you're seeing are visors, which are recleanable. So don't confuse all that very clumpy and cumbersome equipment for the Racal respirators that I so dislike and I think are so non-conducive to safe healthcare.
Very good. Well, thank you. And folks, if you do have questions, please do send them to me by email. My email address is on the title slide and at the bottom of your handout. So again, thank you all for joining us today. And Professor Duzet, thank you again for a tremendous presentation. I look forward to doing this again. We'll talk again soon. Goodbye.
Thank you. Goodbye.